Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Senate Republicans' new health care bill, a GOP victory in Georgia. Congress hears Russians targeted U.S. election systems in 21 states. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell unveiled a new health care bill after months of secret drafting.
I'm pleased that we were able to arrive at a draft that incorporates input from so many different members who represent so many different constituents who are facing so many different challenges.
In Georgia, John Ossoff, the Democratic candidate in Georgia's special congressional election, conceded to Republican Karen Handel.
This is not the outcome any of us were hoping for. But this is the beginning of something much bigger than us.
We'll see. And in a Senate hearing, Jeanette Manfra from the Department of Homeland Security said Russian hackers were targeting deep in U.S. election systems.
We have evidence of 21 states, or election-related systems in 21 states that were targeted.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Juana Summers of CNN, Stephen Hayes of the Weekly Standard, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are we seeing with health care, the Georgia vote, President Trump on tapes, Philando Castile's death on tape? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Juana Summers, senior writer for CNN Politics. Juana, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
Also joining us from Washington, Stephen Hayes, editor of the Weekly Standard. Stephen Hayes, great to have you with us today.
Hey, Tom. Good to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Juana, and Stephen.
Let's go straight to that Republican health care plan. It was hard to know what was in there for a long time. This week, it's out. Here was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday saying it's the right alternative to President Obama's health care law.
We'll eliminate costly Obamacare taxes that are passed on to consumers so we can put downward pressure on premiums, expand tax-free health savings accounts, and deploy targeted tax credits so we can help defray out-of-pocket costs and shift power from Washington to the states.
Will it pass? They need every Republican senator to do that. Plus, who knows, maybe the vice president as well. Got four Republican senators saying they're not in. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul telling reporters yesterday. He and three others, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Ted Cruz of Texas, Mike Lee of Utah, not ready to do it.
I believe the leverage and the count of four people is enough that hopefully those who wrote the bill will say, we want some or all of their votes, and therefore we'll try to make the bill look more like a repeal bill and less like a reiteration of Obamacare bill.
We'll see what's theater there, what's negotiable, what happens next week. Democrats, no way, no how. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi denouncing the bill yesterday. She picked up on the president having called the House health care bill mean after having celebrated its passage in the Rose Garden. Pelosi.
So sad, Mr. President. Heartless. Mean and heartless. And this is the same thing. It's the same thing all over again. We'll do exactly what the House bill did. Increase cost for fewer benefits. It will have an age tax. It's people 50 to 64 may be paying as much as five times more for their benefits. Undermine Medicare by reducing years of its solvency. And tens of millions of people, we'll see what the CBO comes down with, but millions and millions and millions of people will lose their health care.
Stephen Hayes, jump in here. The Democrats are saying sort of the fullest distillation is giant tax cut for the rich and less health care, more expensive for everybody else. How do you see it, Stephen?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about the tax cut question. I think really the best way to look at this was summarized by my colleague Philip Klein at the Washington Examiner, who said, in effect, this is two different bills welded together. One basically keeps in place the structure, the architecture of Obamacare and increases spending in the near term. And then the trade-off there for conservatives is reforms in the long term to Medicaid and other things. And the question I think facing Republican senators is whether you believe that the near-term spending and the preservation of this architecture of Obamacare is worth the promise of these future reforms. And I think history would tell us that there's reason to be skeptical that will see the reforms that are promised.
You're in touch with plenty of conservatives. On the Medicaid front, Democrats are describing this as a kind of eventual gutting or eventual almost phasing out because the rate of inflation coverage won't keep up with health care costs. So it's kind of like a slow wind down. Is that what you see here? Is that what conservatives are looking for, Steve?
I don't. I mean, I think the idea would be that at least the proponents of the bill would argue that, that eventually the health care costs would come down and the discrepancy between that rate of inflation and the actual health care costs wouldn't be as great as it is today. Look, Republicans and conservatives have been talking about reforming Medicaid for years, block granting it, sending it back to the states, trying to make it more efficient. What you're seeing here is the continued expansion of Medicaid under Obamacare through 2021 and then promised reforms much later. There are reasons, as I say, to be skeptical if you're a conservative that you're ever going to see those kinds of reforms down the road. And I think that explains to a certain extent why you have people like Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, Ron Johnson coming out and saying immediately that they are skeptical of this bill, that they don't support it in the current form. And I think that also leaves out a few other Republicans who are also skeptical and just haven't come out. Tom Cotton, Pat Toomey, and others don't like what they've seen. So the trick for Mitch McConnell will be to keep those conservatives on board without making changes to the draft legislation that would alienate moderate Republicans like Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Rob Portman, and others.
Juana Summers, how do you see winners and losers under this health care reform? I mean, we're reading here lower premiums for young Americans, the young and healthy, much lower taxes for the wealthy, but trouble here for the poorer American population and older insurance consumers.
Absolutely. And I think Stephen's right here. The real question about this legislation will be what form it actually passes the Senate, and if indeed it does pass, given the fact that there are already enough Republicans who are saying that they won't vote for it without changes to kill this thing in the water. But I do think that the big takeaway here, for me at least, is that this legislation, if passed in its current form, would fundamentally change the structure of a program that provides health care to 74 million disabled or low-income Americans. And there are a lot of similarities here to the House bill as well that Republicans on Capitol Hill have been talking about. It would eliminate a number of taxes that Obamacare levied on the wealthy to help pay for the ACA. So the wealthy would pay less in taxes here, which is a thing a lot of Democrats don't want to see. It would also add more funds, more federal funding, excuse me, to insurers up until 2019 to help stabilize the insurance market. One of the big losers here, at least according to our analysis over at CNN Money, is that a number of people who are currently Obamacare enrollees will pay more for their out-of-pocket health care services, certainly something that you're not likely to see a lot of Democrats support.
Jack, Donald Trump made a lot of promises on the campaign trail about what he would do in terms of health care. Is he delivering here?
He's not. According to the Center on Budget and Priorities, the cut of nearly $1 trillion in Medicaid to enable nearly as much in tax cuts, that would deliver to the 400 highest income taxpayers over a decade $33 billion. That would be equal to the cost of maintaining the Medicaid expansion in Nevada, West Virginia, Arkansas, and Alaska combined. 400 richest families, in Dr. Johnson's phrase, rich beyond the dreams of avarice, would get $33 billion, and these states and the people in them, the 700,000 people, would lose coverage. And you know, when you get concrete about it, Tom, you really see what that means. The PBS NewsHour did a report the other night on a family in Los Angeles, a young man who had a catastrophic birth situation, adopted, can't do anything for himself. His mother can stay home and care for him because of the Obamacare expansion. She's paid a stipend to do that. All her life is devoted to that. And when you see her talk about him and her eyes light up with pleasure and she runs her hand through his hair, you see what the ingredient is in his life. He has nothing except love. And this bill could very well take that away from him by putting him in a home. And then look at the other end of life, the seniors, two-thirds of seniors in nursing homes. I know something about this from my family. Are on Medicaid. You know, does this mean that the $1 trillion out, does this mean that what Jerome Groopman has beautifully called the offices of dignity cleaning, that the offices of dignity won't be performed as often for the elderly, and they'll have to suffer through indignities? What will it mean for them? And why?
out of political fear. That's driving this, the fear that you will be primaried and that the Club for Growth and the Koch brothers and the Mercers and all the right-wing apparatus will come after you with a purist who will say, you promised to repeal Obamacare. You didn't do it. We're going to primary you. That's what's driving this thing.
Stephen Hayes, a Dickensian future for poor elderly Americans under this plan?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think what Jack describes is something that I think a lot of conservatives would like to see addressed. The part of the problem with, I would argue, both Obamacare and this bill is that, in fact, it doesn't make those distinctions. We're not seeing government programs that are targeting the people that Jack describes, who I think virtually everybody would agree should be the beneficiaries of these kind of government programs. In fact, that's why these programs were designed and conceived in the first place.
But when you cut Medicaid back, they do become the targets, don't they? They do become
the losers.
Well,
I think in many respects you're repurposing Medicaid or allowing states to distribute Medicaid funds the way that they want to. Medicaid, remember, was designed as a safety net program, something that would address the needs of the kinds of people that Jack is describing, at least in the first instance.
Do you think when these cutbacks come, it will mean those will still be addressed or just cut back the offices
of dignity? I do think that those will be addressed. It's inconceivable to me that the young adopted boy that Jack is talking about wouldn't be able to qualify for some government care, given, if he is in fact poor, if his family is in fact poor enough to qualify. I think the problem that conservatives have with Medicaid expansion is that it's incorporated so many people who are able-bodied adults who could otherwise be working and paying their own way on health insurance. And that's been a problem. You've seen expansion beyond what people had projected in places like Ohio and elsewhere, and that's a financial problem.
The question is, does this bill make the inconceivable conceivable? We'll look at that. We'll hear from our listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The Senate Republicans' health bill, Democratic soul-searching after their Georgia loss. Trump says, I didn't tape Comey. U.S. shoots down a Syrian jet. The pain of the Philando Castile tapes. Bill Cosby's hung jury. The death of Otto Warmbier. Juana Summers is with us from CNN Politics. Stephen Hayes from the Weekly Standard. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us as well. What do you see happening with American health care, with this Senate Republican bill that is now out for examination, a vote coming up right away, lickety-split, next week? What do the Democrats need to do after Georgia or, in general, Republicans? Are you heartened by the outcome of that Atlanta vote when it comes to the midterms? And where do we go with this Russia election investigation? We heard more on that this week as well. There's a lot on the line with this health care bill. Americans are watching closely. They're calling in from all over the country. Charlie in Atlanta, Georgia. What do you think, Charlie?
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk with you again. I think that Stephen Hayes and the rest of the Republican so-called intelligentsia are really full of it. This whole discussion makes me want to put a shotgun in my mouth and blow my head
easy,
off.
Easy, Charlie. Easy. What? Why?
We are not talking. You are not talking about health care. You are talking about health insurance.
That's the way this country works. I mean, that's the way it is here. We don't have universal. You don't have a guarantee.
Well, I am 63 years old. I have an Obamacare policy that costs me now $250 a month, and I have a $6,500 deductible.
Ow.
That is tantamount to having no insurance whatsoever.
Will you be better off if the Senate plan goes through, the Republican plan?
The Republican Senate plan does not punish the poor people enough. That's what they do. That's what Mitch McConnell and the rest of the Republican leadership want.
What do you mean it doesn't punish? What do you mean?
Well, it doesn't provide any benefit to anyone. It only provides benefit to wealthy people. I can't even, if I want to go to my, I mean, it's ridiculous. If I go to my doctor, all of it is out of my pocket. All of it.
Charlie, we've got it. We've got it. Juana Summers, I mean, Americans, it is tough to live through this. You know, first we have a plan or a healthcare system that leaves many, many millions just plain uninsured. Then you get the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and some more get insured, many still left out, and others face a kind of erratic markets in some states and uncertainty. Now you get this, and Charlie, with a $6,500 deductible, fears it just gets worse. Is there a point at which, Juana, Americans just say, wait a minute, this whole thing has just become too big a mess. We want something fundamentally different?
Sure. And I think that Charlie brings up an important point that often gets lost here in Washington, D.C., and that is that this isn't just about a legislative victory for one side or the other. There are real people, both wealthy and not wealthy, young and old, who are trying to figure out how to best come up with coverage and, as Charlie notes, healthcare for their families. And there's no question that taking any partisan views out of it aside, if either the Senate bill that was released on Thursday, likely to see a vote next week, or the House bill, either one were to pass, it will fundamentally reshape an industry that is responsible for an enormous chunk of the American economy that affects every household in this country. And I think that's why you're seeing so many callers call in about this here. I know I've been talking to lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Their offices are flooded about this very issue, a signature legislative accomplishment of the past administration. One of the things that President Trump said that he would fight to change if he was elected. I think you can't understate the importance of this issue to
Sharon in Ravenna, Ohio. Sharon, you're on.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Yes, I believe that this is like voodoo health care. Poof, when you need it, it's gone. You have a big deductible. You're young. You think you're doing well. I just had to have an emergency CAT scan. It was $9,000. I have Medicare. I'm in great shape. But for somebody else who has a $10,000 deductible, they're signing on the dotted line, maybe even going bankrupt. So there's no basic services provided at all. They're trying to take away basic services like routine doctor visits to monitor health, x-rays, emergency room. You fall.
Were you satisfied with the Affordable Care Act? Was that doing it for you, for the country, really, Sharon?
Well, I think it could be improved. I think it could be improved. I'm on Medicare, so don't get me wrong, but I care about other people other than myself. I'm well cared for on Medicare, well cared for. I want everybody to have the same care that I have. I think all human beings, we are all human beings, we are all susceptible to illness, to injury, and that if this country really has a heart, it will take care of people.
You wonder if the country just goes another way at some point, or maybe not. Maybe we just muddle through. One more, Oklahoma. Nathaniel, you're on the air, Oklahoma City. Thanks, Nathaniel.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here. Listen, I'm an Oklahoma supporter of the Affordable Care Act, and I'm just sick about what's happening now. And I wanted to bring up that as a part of the Affordable Care Act, the American Hospital Association agreed voluntarily to take lower payments for Medicaid patients, expecting the volume to increase, which would more than cover their losses. Now, Oklahoma did not accept Medicaid expansion.
Right.
More about that later. But all the hospitals and rural clinics that were expecting Medicaid expansion were simply screwed because they're taking the lower payments without the increased numbers of patients.
So what's going to happen, Nathaniel? What happens?
Well, many of them are threatened with going out of business. They're getting rid of doctors and nurses because they can't afford to make the payments. So there was a promise of Medicaid expansion, and then ultimately that did not come in Republican states like Oklahoma because Republicans did not want Obamacare.
Yeah, Nathaniel, I appreciate your call. Stephen Hayes, does this hold together for Republicans? I mean, you've described some of the things Republicans want, the changes they want to see, but of course there can be a political price if people don't feel like they're getting the services they need. And any number of people have pointed out that it is rural, poorer voters who may actually get the short end of the stick here. What's the political risk factor here for the GOP, Stephen?
Well, I think there's a big one. And I think it's in part because Republicans haven't addressed the kinds of concerns we're hearing from the callers and the ones articulated by Jack before. People don't know what's in this bill. Republicans did a poor job over the past 6-7 years. And in particular, as they prepared to roll out these proposed reforms, of explaining to people what has happened under Obamacare. And
we've heard endlessly about Obamacare, but we've heard very little about the new bill. I mean, until Thursday, it was just black box.
Yeah, well, I don't agree that we've heard plenty about Obamacare. I think Republicans could have done a much better job about that. There have been high-profile moments, President Trump's first address to Congress, where he could have opted to have to highlight people who have had problems, seen their premiums increase, seen their deductibles increase, and instead chose to highlight people who were, you know, family members of victims of illegal immigrant crime.
But the GOP
crime.
Will own it now if this goes through. I don't know if it's going to be called Trump-care or what, or McConnell-care, but... What about the political risk there?
Well, I think there's a big one. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think you talk to some Republicans on Capitol Hill and they say, well, if we just let it collapse, everybody will still call it Obamacare and blame the president, President Obama. That's just not true. I mean, that is self-delusion. Republicans own this. They, I think, owed it to people after having campaigned on it for 7 years to come up with serious reform proposals and haven't, I think, to a certain extent because they were afraid of the kinds of arguments that we're hearing now.
Yeah.
And there's not any serious – I mean, just one point on the calls and on Republicans. Mm-hmm. At some point, we have to reform entitlements in this country. The math is the math. We are going broke because largely of entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. If we don't get serious about reforming entitlements, both political parties, you know, we can have these discussions about, you know, the morality of helping as many people as we possibly can. But somebody's got to pay for this. And we need to have a serious discussion about that.
Is this really going through next week? I mean, you've got the four holdouts in the Senate. We heard from Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and others there. But here's a listener who writes to us online, says they'll make a big show of a few Republican holdouts pushing to make these minor changes to the bill. Then they will all vote to pass the crappy bill, this listener says, as agreed by all in their secret meetings. Is this already baked in the cake? Is it just theater headed for the vote, Stephen? Or is there a real chance it will stumble and not pass?
I think there's a chance it'll stumble and not pass. I mean, these objections that in particular these six conservatives I mentioned have are serious and I would argue principled objections. I think the objections that the moderates have, they have because they believe these things. And look, if anybody can pull this off, it is Mitch McConnell. He's a master tactician. He's very good at this kind of thing. But Rand Paul is unlikely to vote for this, I think, no matter what. Mike Lee, I think, unless they get rid of the Title I regulations, is unlikely to vote for this. Ted Cruz, I think, wants to be a yes, but could easily be a no. Ron Johnson has raised objections all along to this. Tom Cotton savaged the House version of this bill, and the Senate bill looks a lot like the House version. So I think it's a real possibility that this doesn't pass.
We're going to talk all about the details on Monday. But, Jack, for now, we've got a lot more to look at. Last word on this health package put on the table by Republicans in the Senate?
Well, you know, you have to note Mr. McConnell, who is, if nothing, if not cynical, has set this up so that the cuts, these really serious cuts in Medicaid, won't take effect until after the next presidential election. Probably that's just a coincidence. But, I mean, that's strategy. That is Mr. McConnell. That is the way this is designed. And some people might call that, you know, running away from the consequences, but good politics, certainly.
Let's turn to politics and what happened in Georgia this week, the 6th district there. Karen Handel, former attorney general in Georgia, who after mountains of money was spent by both sides, $50-60 million spent, the most ever spent on a congressional race, this in a special election, came out on top over her young Democratic challenger, John Ossoff, 30 years old, made a big run. A lot of Democrats had invested in that, and it did not work out. Here was President Trump in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a campaign-style rally, the kind he likes to go out and do this week. He's sort of airing grievances first, and then was celebrating, gloating about the Republican victory in Georgia.
They have phony witch hunts going against me. They have everything going. And you know what? All we do is win, win, win. We won last night.
All we do is win, win, win. Well, that's true in special elections. The Democrats have not taken one yet. The day after the election in Georgia, you had Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio arguing that the reason Democrats keep losing special elections, he said, is due to the toxicity of their party's brand, a toxic brand.
Everything's in contrast to who you're running against. And that's why I say I don't think people in the Beltway are realizing just how toxic the Democratic Party brand is in so many of the countries. This is a party that many of us grew up hearing. This is the party for the working class. And we've gotten away from that economic message about how do we help working class people.
ouch for the Democrats, just how toxic the brand is. Wanda Summers, what do you make first of the results in Georgia and then of Tim Ryan's analysis?
So let's start with the results. First of all, for some context for listeners, this Georgia 6th district is a district that Republicans have held for nearly 40 years. So despite the fact that
Newt Gingrich district, Tom Price district.
Exactly. This is a deep red district. So despite the fact that President Trump did not do particularly well there, despite winning it by a razor thin margin, this would have been a really humbling defeat for Republicans. This was the most expensive House race we've seen, which I think is an indication of just how grueling 2018 is going to be for the national parties. The biggest thing I was watching that I thought was really interesting, though, in John Ossoff, the Democrat in this race, is how he handled Trump. At the beginning of the race, prior to April's primary, he spent a lot of time talking about Trump. He launched his campaign saying that his goal was to make Trump furious. But as it became clear that he might actually win that April primary, and as we continued on to this week's election, he stopped talking about him as much, even in a district where, as I said, he only won by a razor thin margin. I think that shows that Democrats have some learning to do about how to best handle the president in these competitive districts. It's going to be a different playbook than we saw in 2016, when almost every single moment of every race that we watched across the country was about the president invoking then candidate Trump at every step of the way. So I think that's going to be great to watch. You also mentioned Congressman Ryan's comments. This is not a new complaint. One of the things we saw in this race is that it seemed at moments that Karen Handel, the Republican who won that race, was running not against John Ossoff, but against Nancy Pelosi. She's the highest ranking Democrat in the House, and she was constantly invoked time after time after time. And I think that shows that Democrats really do need to sit down and have a reckoning about what their brand looks like. We've seen complaints this week on Capitol Hill that perhaps Ms. Pelosi needs to leave. Perhaps someone else should be leading the party there. There's been complaints for Democrats for years about the weathering age of their leaders. I've reported on this for NPR back, I think, in 2014. So nothing new, but certainly with Republicans controlling the House and the Senate takes on a new shape.
Nancy Pelosi, not showing any sign of going this week, said yesterday she's worth the trouble as Democrats' leader in the House.
You want me to sing my praises? Is that what you're saying? Why should I? Well, I'm a master legislator. I am a strategic, politically astute leader. I am leadership is recognized by many around the country, and that is why I'm able to attract the support that I do.
Let's hear right from the heart of the election this week. Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson's calling. Jackson, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thank you for the best show on radio.
Hey.
I just wanted to mention that, in my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of other 10,000 volunteers that poured out across the country to help John Ossoff, we missed the mark on one thing, Tom, and that is the campaign focused very hard on the affluent areas, the middle class, the upper middle class areas in the heart of the 6th District, where people's minds were to a great degree already made up. Now, not that that didn't need to be done, but I can tell you as a person that was out volunteering every single week and in this last week every single day, a lot of my fellow canvassers and volunteers said, going up to doors that already have five hangers on them and people saying, if I get one more phone call or knock on my door, I'm not voting at all. In the meantime, Tom, I can tell you, I know by talking to people, that we did not do enough in the areas such as DeKalb County, the working class, lower class, especially the black neighborhoods, where the challenge is not getting to the poll necessarily, but they don't even know if they can get off work in many cases. These are people that are
to vote.
And the statistics are in these areas, for example, like I just mentioned, DeKalb County, 80% Democrat, 80% that would have voted for John Ossoff. But unfortunately, we had about approximately a 25% turnout.
Jackson, we hear that you were out there and working it hard. Jack Beatty, just a minute before the break here. What about Jackson's testimony there from the front lines, from the Democrat side, and Tim Ryan's charge, toxic brand, Democrats?
Yeah, Jackson really lights it up, doesn't he? I mean, that's a paradigm of the Hillary Clinton campaign, focusing on the suburbs, forgetting about mobilization of your base. And Nancy Pelosi, the Tim Ryan point, she's the face of the party. And what does she say about herself? I'm the biggest fundraiser in the country. She has raised, according to the New York Times, $568 million since 2002. Is this what a Democrat is?
You know, Daddy Warbucks. I mean,
didn't
it's
work
like
in, didn't work in
it didn't work in Georgia. It didn't work for Hillary Clinton either. She outspent Trump.
So, Stephen Hayes, what do you take from Georgia 6?
Well, it is interesting to listen to Democrats sort of wrangle with the identity of their party, and I think the question has been framed well by the caller and both by Jack.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Jared Kushner appeared at a technology council meeting at the White House Monday. First time many of us have ever actually heard his voice.
Our goal here is simple. We are here to improve the day-to-day lives of the average citizen. That's a core promise, and we are keeping it.
In a memorial Wednesday for slain Virginia teen Nabran Hassanan, friends of the Muslim Students Association, from the Muslim Students Association at her high school, described her in one word each.
Nabra was beautiful.
Nabra was compassionate.
Nabra was generous.
Nabra was brave.
Sad. And this week, a member of the hung jury in the Bill Cosby sexual assault trial, who asked to remain unidentified, said Cosby had suffered enough.
My personal feeling is whatever the man did, he has already paid his price. Suffered.
Well, we'll see. A week in the news we're looking at today with Juana Summers of CNN Politics, Stephen Hayes, editor-in-chief of the Weekly Standard, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join us. What do you think of the president's tapes, no tapes, two-step on James Comey? Where do we go with this Russian election investigation now? After Otto Warmbier, what happens with the U.S. and North Korea? Are you still aghast at the Philando Castile tapes, the death of Nabra Hassanan, the Muslim girl, the hung jury, and the Cosby case? A little more on politics. We've got to move on. Terrence, though, at first in Omaha, Nebraska. Terrence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Tom. I was calling about those special election results. I don't think it's as big of a problem as the media is making it out to be, because these special elections happened in Montana, Kansas, South Carolina, and Georgia. They are deep red states. They're not even purple states. I'd be a little bit more worried if the Democrats lost all special elections and they were in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Colorado. I mean, that Kansas district, I think, voted for Trump by 27 points, and then that special election was, they won by 7 points.
Yeah, so. But you've got to win somewhere where Trump won last time, right? I mean, otherwise you're...
Well, exactly. So I'm looking to win in Wisconsin. I'm looking to win in Pennsylvania and, you know, those places. And I think winning in a district that you lost by 2 points but haven't been represented by a Democrat in 40 years is a step in the right direction.
Fair enough, Terrence. Keep hope alive and all that if you're a Democrat. Republicans taking solace in this, afraid that it might go the other way. And, of course, it could have an impact on the health care vote itself, because Republicans may feel a little more secure in their skins. We've got listeners writing here, though, online. One says Republicans should have something that is good and sustainable on health care. Otherwise, voters will revolt in 2018. Jenny writes to us on Facebook, "My dad saw Medicaid patients as a dentist. Many children had nothing else. Medicaid is needed." I want to turn and look at the hearings this week on Russian interference in the U.S. elections. More testimony from the intelligence community and beyond that it was real, that it was deep. And we heard this week that there was targeting going on, not just getting into the Democrats' campaign emails and all the rest, but right into state election systems. Not that they were tampered with this time, but that they were tested. We had Adam Schiff, who's become very prominent in all this, on the House Intelligence Committee questioning former Homeland Security Advisor Jay Johnson over Russian attempts to hack into, get into the whole U.S. election system or election campaign season last year. Schiff's ranking member on that committee asked Johnson about the Obama administration's response to the Russian interference.
Why wasn't it more important to tell the American people the length and breadth of what the Russians were doing to interfere in an election than any risk that it might be seen as putting your hand on the scale? Didn't the public have a compelling need to know?
And here was the former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson trying to explain all that.
There was an ongoing election, and many would criticize us for perhaps taking sides in the election. So that had to be carefully considered. One of the candidates, as you recall, was predicting that the election was going to be rigged in some way. And so we were concerned that by making the statement, we might in and of itself be challenging the integrity of the election process itself.
Okay, it was awkward, but there was apparently, we hear from testimony, a lot of awareness of Russian interference. Juana, what did we learn this week about A, what that interference may have looked like, and B, where these investigations may now go?
Sure. I think we heard, frankly, some of the testimony on Capitol Hill left a lot more questions unanswered than answering questions. We heard an official from DHS, the Department of Homeland Security's Cyber Intelligence Division, say that 21 states' election-related systems were potentially targeted by, as they describe it, Russian government cyber actors. Now, this official said that none of those systems were involved in vote counting, but they also didn't name the states. They didn't say how many were actually breached. They didn't really say that if some of these states even knew that they were targeted. I think that raises a lot of questions for those in Washington and around the country who have questions about what Russia's role is, how advanced their abilities are. And a number of Democrats were particularly frustrated with the level of secrecy with which DHS has handled this and say that, you know, it's actually more threatening to public safety by holding information like this back from the American people.
Stephen Hayes, where do you see this going?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things that, former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said in his testimony was that these attacks were ordered by, quote, Vladimir Putin himself, unquote, which was quite a revelation. That was something that certainly I hadn't heard before. If there's intelligence to back that up, and I suspect that there is, I'd be interested to know exactly what – how we know that, why he could testify to that. But I think the overarching takeaway from these hearings and from our discussion of this controversy over the past several months is that Russia is clearly launched an aggressive campaign to disrupt U.S. democracy, our democratic republic. And we better get serious about taking them on and pushing back on this immediately. And I think to a certain extent, both political parties are playing politics on this without grappling with the more serious issue of what this means for our election systems in 2018, in 2020 and beyond.
Jack, I want to come to you on this. But first, if I may, Minneapolis, John's calling. John, you're on.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I was, you know, I just think that that the Russian hack, you know, what didn't concern the Democrats until they lost, you know, and now it concerns them. But I think it was a Seth Rich thing that really got things in motion.
But can you see? I guess at some level you might have sympathy for the Obama administration feeling very wary about in the last days of the campaign or last weeks coming in and saying the Russians are in the middle of all this. That would be a pretty unsettling charge. Can you see a reasonable explanation for them restraining on doing that? Or does it just look like a mistake or now sour grapes to you, John?
Well, it might be a little both, but I just think that they didn't think it was going to concern them. Maybe they thought Hillary was going to win. I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
they're just too overconfident.
Jack, come in here. I mean, there's so much here. I mean, first of all, will we now see, as Stephen Hayes says, an aggressive campaign? An aggressive effort to get at what really went on. Will we only have that if the collusion charge is somehow downplayed or put in the back seat here? Will Republicans lead if we don't have Trump in the bullseye, though he may still be? Mueller's work is still out there. And what about the fact that it wasn't put front and center when it was actually happening? And apparently a lot was known, Jack.
Yeah, well, to John's point, the Washington Post today has a big takeout on, you know, the background of this, how the Obama administration dealt with it. And again, you see the assumption Hillary was going to win. It wasn't worth, you know, the polls were saying it, and that they were, as everybody, they thought she was going to win. And then there was just bad timing. You know, one of their, Jay Johnson's announcements about this threat came just, I think, an hour before the Access Hollywood tape came out, and it was completely overshadowed by that. But, you know, now these 21 states, we need to find out what states they are. And we need to find out what happened in those states with voter rolls. Local reporting is coming up with some interesting findings. Dallas County, for example, overwhelming for Hillary Clinton. It was targeted, I think, 17 times, according to their sources by outside groups to try to get their voting rolls. And neighboring counties that were Republican were not. Durham County in North Carolina, that was targeted, not only targeted, but there was some playing around with the voting rolls such that there were huge lines of people trying to vote. And it was reported on, you know, will we get all the voters in?
Wait, are you saying that Russian hackers produced that situation, Jack? I didn't hear that.
What I'm trying to say, Tom, is it likely that Boris and Natasha knew that? Or did they get somebody who was saying, you know, helping them pick out the places to go? I don't know. But that's the kind of question I think that the House committee is going to start getting into. They have next week, they're going to have a testimony from one of the number people and political strategist people in the Trump campaign. So it remains to be seen. But I just can't believe that over there in Russia, they know how to target these counties.
You can't believe it? I don't know. Pay close attention. It's not that hard. You've got election analysts all over the world who watch American elections. And then, of course, there's the issue of President Trump. You know, James Comey testified that, he felt like he was being pressured to back off on this investigation. The president came out with his tweet saying, hey, be careful what you say, Comey, because there could be tapes. Then this week tweeting, I didn't make tapes. I don't have tapes. He talked earlier today with Fox and Friends. This is the president saying he'd never taped any interactions between himself and the former CIA director, FBI director.
I didn't tape, and I don't have any tape, and I didn't tape. But when he found out that that there may be tapes out there, whether it's governmental tapes or anything else, and who knows, I think his story may have changed.
Well, whose story changed here? Wait a minute. Kayla in Johnson City, Tennessee. Kayla, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have something to say about how Trump responded to saying now that he actually doesn't have these tapes that he said he did. But Trump at first claimed that he had tapes of conversations with Comey. And
well, that he might have, that they might be out there,
They might be out there, but he had threatened to release them as if he had some kind of blackmail on Comey. And then now comes out and says that he never taped anything. This is just like another Twitter rant, just like the last one he did, where he claimed that the Obama administration had been wiretapping him. I don't understand why the American people still believe Trump when he's constantly caught in lies like this or misconceptions. He's proven time and time again to be an untrustworthy person, and yet people will still so blindly follow him. So I guess that's my question, is that what about Trump makes people want to do this? Why are people so blindly following someone who has proven again to be a liar?
Kayla, I appreciate your call. I mean, that last line that we heard in the Fox and Friends tape, I think his, Comey's story may have changed. Boy, that seems kind of low to me, suggesting that when the president's story seems to be changing here. Juana Summers, where does this, does the investigation go sternly ahead? As Stephen Hayes says, we have to know what happened here. Does that happen only if the collusion charge is somehow sidelined? Is this rolling forward? What do you see happening?
I think that this entire thing on whether there are tapes or there are no tapes is truly a self-inflicted crisis by this White House. And it, frankly, it's one of the more surreal things I've seen covering this president and candidate Trump. And that's saying something given what the last couple of years have looked like. I think it'll be really interesting to see, because up until this Fox and Friends interview that aired, some of it is aired today.
Yeah.
The president has not been questioned about these claims, about his new statement made on Twitter, as many are, that he himself did not record James Comey. There have been no briefings or opportunities for us as reporters to do so. And I know a number of Democrats, including Adam Schiff, have called for saying that this needs to not just be an answer from the president in 140 characters. This needs to be an answer from the White House counsel office. There still could be a there, and this is not sufficient. I think if your last caller is any indication, I think there are a number of people in the public who also want to know what the president was talking about 6 weeks ago, why up until today, until yesterday, rather, there's been no answer for that. And if he didn't tape, what was he alluding to, and where does the statement come from? Because it seems to have come out of nowhere.
Weird. Not least, we've got to look at the Philando Castile tapes that came out this week. This is the dash cam footage of Officer Geronimo Yanez fatally shooting Philando Castile 7 times last July in front of his girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, and the baby in the car. She also was live streaming, but this is the first time we saw this. Of course, Yanez was acquitted of all charges last Friday. Listeners, this is tough sound. If you've got, if you're squeamish, don't listen. Turn it off right now. But here was the exchange as it came up to the seven shots.
Sir, I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me.
Don't reach for it, then. Don't pull it out.
Sickening and too late. And you've got, when you listen to that, you just have to wonder, was that really necessary? I'm not a policeman, but boy, this is tough to watch. Jack Beatty, what do you see in that tape?
Something that's unfortunately, tragically, more typical than our pride would allow us to see. I saw an expert talking about this last night, and she said that there have been about 500 or so police shootings of African-Americans in the last decade or so. Of those, there were 89 indictments, and of the 89 indictments, only 25 policemen were found guilty of manslaughter or murder. That seems wrong. That just seems wrong. And there is that Supreme Court decision that basically says juries have to look at things through the policeman's eyes. Is there a fear of being killed, and therefore that justifies force? There's something that decision seems to me to have made to have invited injustices here against African-Americans.
Juana Summers, the whole country watching this, African-Americans watching this, to watch that video and then see the acquittal, how do you see it settling in?
I think that there's still a lot of unrest. Many people in this country saw Philando Castile's fiance's Facebook Live that showed the aftermath of this shooting. But this really shows one of the clearest pictures we've seen yet of these fatal encounters between African-American men and police. What strikes me most is that just 74 seconds elapsed from when that traffic stop happened until Philando Castile was shot. And it's really hard to hear the pain and see that reality come out, I think, for a lot of people who are having these conversations with their kids and their husbands and their families.
Stephen Hayes, I know you weren't in the courtroom, but does that acquittal make sense to you?
It doesn't make sense to me. And as heartbreaking as the actual video itself was, there was another video of his girlfriend talking to the 4-year-old who was in the car that is absolutely tragic and heartbreaking.
This country has a lot of thinking to do, changing to do, I think. Stephen Hayes, editor-in-chief of the Weekly Standard, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Juana Summers at CNN Politics. Thank you, Juana.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.